I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. When we were kids, it was pretty easy to make friends and to have a best friend. Some of those relationships have lasted a lifetime, while others have fallen away. Now that we're adults, when was the last time you made a new friend? Someone you could confide in, who cared about your well-being and you theirs, someone you were excited to be with. Often the responsibilities for work and family have left little time and energy to find new friends and to nurture the friendships we already have. The pandemic has made building and maintaining friendships even harder, what with distancing and lockdowns. So today on Radio Times, why having an adult friend is good for our health and how to make friends when we are all grown up. Joining us is Marissa Franco. She's a professor at the University of Maryland and a friendship expert. She's the author of a forthcoming book, Platonic, The Surprising New Science of How to Make and Keep Friends as an Adult. And Marissa Franco, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Jonathan Bowman. He's a professor of communication studies at the University of San Diego. Got up early to be with us on Radio Times. And Jonathan Bowman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And we want to make sure our listeners join our conversation. So you can email us anytime at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Marissa Franco, let me begin with you, kind of a broad-based question here. But I think we all know about the importance of friendship at most stages in our life, and probably remember those childhood friends we had. But what about as adults? What does friendship in adulthood bring us that we don't have if we don't have friends?
So many things. I mean, human connection is just central to both our physical and mental health. Studies actually find that loneliness is as toxic for our bodies as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Being lonely is more toxic than having a poor diet or a lack of exercise. And we are such social creatures, so we just have this deep need for connection. I think with also friendship specifically, friends help us expand our sense of our own identity, right? That's why many of us have been feeling probably like unease or just the feeling that centrally we're like a little bit off because we haven't seen our friends as much. And I think also we tend to think about friends as antithetical to romantic relationships, but the research actually finds that our romantic relationships are more likely to survive periods of turbulence when we have friends, and also conflict in our romantic relationships affects us less when we have friends.
So many important and good reasons to have friendship, have friends as adults. How do you see it, Jonathan Bowman?
Yeah, you know, there's actually been research along the lines of what Marissa was talking about that says social isolation can increase the risk of premature death by about 30%. So it really is this core physical impact based upon our emotional experience. And I think that's the biggest thing to keep in mind is that it is an emotional and an intellectual experience when you feel isolated, when you feel like you don't have friends. And also, like we said before, there's a difference in the types of relationships that we keep in our lives. And friends play a role that's very different from a romantic partner or a parent or a child. And it's important to make sure that we keep maintaining those friendship relationships, even though they may not be emphasized as much in our culture.
Well, let me pick up on that. And Marissa, go back to you. And since we're talking about adult friendship, adult relationships, do you think there's too much or an over-focus on marriage and not enough focus on friendship in adulthood?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of us have received messages around finding someone to be our one and only or finding someone to complete us as if we find one person, the search for social connection will be over, right? But like I said, we know from the research that part of being in a healthy romantic relationship is each person having friends, and that in fact improves the relationship and makes it better. And, you know, I think we also tend to over compartmentalize what we see as appropriate in friendships versus romantic relationships, where friendship is actually the foundation of a healthy romantic relationship. If you feel like you're friends with your partner, that predicts how long the relationship will last, how good the sex is. So I see friendship as part of any healthy relationship, whether romantic or non, just that sense of trust and that sense of acceptance that you have, that sense that, you know, this person is going to show up for you. All those parts of friendship are critical, I think, for all of our relationships to thrive.
To you, Jonathan, what does it take then to be a good adult friend?
Oh, well, you know, I think probably emotional support is the biggest, you know, predictor of the quality of friendship. You know, we have lots of different kinds of intimacy that we can engage in with the people that we care about in our lives. Emotional support is having those important conversations, or, you know, kind of discussing or communicating what's going on in our lives and receiving positive affirmation and responses. So I think that's something that we oftentimes overlook, particularly as men. We oftentimes overlook kind of the importance of talking things through, right? So it's great to spend time with other people, but sometimes you need to have a little bit more depth to it, which I think applies to anyone regardless of your gender identity.
Well, let me talk about men, and we should talk about women and everybody in between, but let me go back to you, Jonathan Bowman. And do you see male friendships as different, that they look different from female friendships?
You know, I think that our culture really talks about male friendships as different than friendships of anyone else. And I think part of that is just maybe because of the way that we tend to frame friendships to other people. Oftentimes people tend to view men's friendships as less significant than women's friendships because there's not a lot of depth that people are kind of witnessing from the outside of the relationship. But researchers have actually found there's this idea of covert intimacy, which is where we're engaging in important conversations with people, even though we might be doing something else. So if I meet up with a friend and I play racquetball and then afterwards we go out for pizza and a beer, we're not staying completely silent that whole time. But if I come home and I tell my romantic partner or, you know, a kid, you know, anyone, if I tell them what I did with my friend, I'm going to say, oh, we played racquetball and then grabbed some pizza, right? So there's kind of this cultural narrative that is formed that says that men aren't having these deep, significant relationships. But the research actually says men want them, and men are oftentimes having them with close friends as well. We just tend not to view them as close just simply because it's not as forefronted because of kind of our cultural norms.
Marissa, do you see gender sex differences when it comes to what adult friendships look like?
Yeah, I mean, they're slight. I think they tend to be a little bit exaggerated in the research, but they are there. Women tend to experience more intimacy in their friendships, for example. There's some research that even men experience more intimacy in their relationships with women than in their relationships with men, but there's sort of mixed results on that. And I think as we've been seeing friendships decline more and more over time, the decline for men has been even more so. So I think four times as many of us have no friends as like 20 or 30 years ago, but
really?
For men, it's five times as many men have no friends. Yeah, it's you know, been a steady decline in our networks, and unfortunately that's affected men even more so than women. But like Dr. Bowman shares, like, I think friendship is critical for people of all genders, absolutely. And men and women are really looking for the same things in friendships. They're looking for that support. They're looking to share things about themselves. They're looking to be affirmed and feel valued. And I think sometimes we make out that men don't have these fundamental human needs that we all have, and that's just simply untrue.
Well, let me do a quick follow-up before I go back to Jonathan. To you, Marissa, then, why this pretty precipitous decline in friendships over the last couple of decades? What's happening?
Yeah, it's really complicated. I mean, we talk about the rise of, like, social media, right, and then people having these loose networks rather than actual tight, close networks, but it's the picture is more complicated. How you use social media affects your friendships. It depends on how you use it, right? So if you use social media to replace your in-person friendships, then you're going to be more lonely. But if you use social media to supplement your in-person friendships, you're checking in, you're reaching out, you're planning in-person hangouts through connecting on social media, then you're less lonely, right? And so social media can kind of push us in either direction of loneliness, depending on how we're really using it. But it can be, I think, one reason that can contribute to loneliness if we're not using social media in the right ways. I don't know. I feel like it's really hard for me to like put a pulse on like why our social networks have been declining for the last few decades. Maybe Dr. Bowman has some idea here, but when you look into history, you see that people haven't always been this lonely. We think of it as natural and inherent, but in fact, the Economist talked about loneliness as the leprosy of the 21st century, because before industrialization, we all lived in our communities and we saw the same people over time. So I guess that's another factor. People are moving more, and that's related to having friendships that are more fragile, as well as we move for work and we move for school. And so that residential mobility can also be a contributor.
Do you see it that way, Jonathan Bowman, which is that people are making, I guess, fewer friends and that social media is at least, I mean, we think of our Facebook, quote unquote, friends. I'm not sure that's a substitute to an actual friendship.
Right. Yeah, I would say that those social media friends, you know, they may often include real friends, but, you know, quote unquote, real friends. But most of the time, it's a wide variety of people that you might not even interact with ever again once you've added them as a friend. There was a recent study done by a company, actually, that was looking at friendships, and they found that the average adult has about 16 people that they think of as friends, but of those, they really only consider three of those, like, friends for life, and five of those as people that they actually like or care about. So it's really funny. We have, you know, we have these large groups of people that we might call our friends that are really acquaintances, and then we have these smaller and smaller groups of people that we actually like. And of those, you know, life is complicated, and so stuff gets in the way, so we may not be spending time with those small groups of people. But I think Dr. Franco really brought up a really good point. Like, a lot of our opportunity to develop friendship is also diminishing as well, right? So part of it is the rise of social media. Part of it is just the way we live our lives, you know. One of the ways that we meet people and make friends and feel socially connected with other people is by going out and having random accidental interactions with people, you know, buying a cup of coffee and smiling at the barista, and, you know, eventually 3 weeks later they know your name, and, you know, that kind of thing. And what's really interesting is, you know, the more and more that we move towards purchasing stuff online, the more and more we move towards having to, you know, go through a drive-through because of the pandemic rather than walking in and sitting down for a while. Like, these things are just diminishing our general overall social interaction. So while I think friendship has changed over time, I think it's also changed a lot just in the last 2 years.
And Marissa Franco, what, about a minute before our first break here, but three good friends for life? I mean, that seems like a gift.
I think that's absolutely a gift. You know, the biggest bang for your buck in terms of friendship is if you go from zero friends to one friend. That is going to be most life-changing for your mental health versus going from two to three or three to four. And so having those really, really close friends, the tight-knit group of people, I think, you know, we see from the research that quality does matter more than quantity, although quantity does help too. But overall, quality packs more punch in terms of experiencing better mental health outcomes. So having that small group, having that small clique, I think there's not necessarily something wrong with that. There's obviously reasons to have a larger network to have access to opportunities. But I think if you're someone who's like, I have three or four really good friends, I think that's also great.
And that is Marissa Franco. She's a professor at the University of Maryland. She is a friendship expert. She's got a book coming out titled Platonic, The Surprising New Science of How to Make and Keep Friends as an Adult. And Jonathan Bowman is with us as well, professor of communication studies at the University of San Diego. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And we do want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. And waiting in the wings, we have a writer who will tell us about finding a friend in Bozeman, Montana. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road and back again. Your heart is true. You're a pal and a confidant. And if you threw a party, you invited everyone you knew, you would see the biggest gift would be from me. And the card attached would say, thank you for being a friend.
Thank you for being a friend, performed by Cynthia Fee, was the theme song for the NBC hit sitcom The Golden Girls. We are talking about being a friend, having a friend in adulthood. Joining us now is writer Catherine Smythe, and she will tell us what it took to make a good friend when she moved to Bozeman, Montana, and had left her Brooklyn friends behind. She joined us by Skype from Bozeman, Montana. And Catherine Smythe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have her?
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Oh, good. Yeah, you're very welcome. Nice to have you with us on the show. You moved to Bozeman to be with your boyfriend or husband. I wasn't sure which. But you left behind some of your some of your Brooklyn friends. When you got to Bozeman, you came to a place you didn't know. You didn't know anyone except for Ben. What was it like to be someplace without a friend?
It was hard for me, and you know, it's honestly still hard for me because it's pretty new. I lived in Brooklyn for nearly 20 years. I moved there right after I graduated from college, and a lot of my friends from college moved there as well. So I'm 40 now, but for the first sort of the first two kind of adult decades of my life, I had a really solid, close-knit group of friends that were really, really important to me. When I met Ben, who, as you said, lives in Bozeman, Montana, we were long distance for a little while, but then he, long story, got a tenure track position. And so I thought, okay, well, I will move to Bozeman. and I showed up and, you know, again, as someone who in my old life was seeing friends almost every day, going out to dinner, getting drinks, going for walks, it felt really, really hard and really isolating.
Were you lonely?
I was lonely in a certain sense. I mean, I think, you know, Ben has great friends here, and he was introducing me to a lot of his people. And so I was actually being very social and seeing a lot of people. But what I was really missing were, you know, what you were talking about earlier in this program, the really sort of intimate conversations and being with friends who really knew me and whom I could say, you know, this is hard or, you know, how are you doing on a level where it felt like we were being really, really honest and really open with each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You went to Bumble to find a friend and you did find somebody, Steph, you call her in your article in The Atlantic, someone that you just connected with. What was it? What was different about her?
Well, I mean, I think up until that point, I had not only met sort of friends of Ben's, some of whom I thought were really great, and I still think are really great, but they've been friends for a long time. And so one of the things that I realized was that breaking into a long established friend group was pretty difficult to do when you're 40 years old. And I totally get it because, you know, I was the exact same way when I was in New York. I would meet someone and they would be nice and great, but I wouldn't necessarily then suddenly say, oh, well, why don't you come do absolutely everything with me? You know, which is what I was looking for. So what I realized is, you know, long story, but I'm divorced. So I was online dating for about 5 years before I met Ben. So I was sort of familiar with the entire infrastructure of meeting people online. And I sort of realized as I was meeting Ben's friends or meeting friends of friends that I'd heard about that it was just actually so much more like dating than I had ever expected, trying to meet new friends in a new place. And so I, you know, as a kind of last resort, I was like, oh, well, I guess maybe I'll get back on Bumble.
Wow.
And you know, oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and it worked. Catherine, hold on one second. Let me get Jonathan Bowman and also Marissa Franco back in on our conversation. And Marissa, I'll turn to you. What we're hearing from Catherine was she was very intentional. She was looking for a friend. She actually went on Bumble to find a friend, and she did indeed. But this idea of being so intentional is a kind of, you know, friendship is a form of dating. Do you see it that way?
I really do see it as an intentional act. And in fact, I think we hold on to this myth that friendship happens organically and it really harms us. There's a study that actually found that people that see friendship as something that happens based on effort are less lonely years later, whereas those that see it as something that happened based on luck are more lonely years later because they're not making that effort. They're just waiting for someone to fly into their lives. So I think it's really, really great that she was taking that initiative. And I think that that's really necessary for adult friendships in particular, because when we're kids, we have environments that allow for continuous unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability, which sociologists argue is central for friendship, mm-hmm. to cultivate friendships organically. But as adults, we don't often have environments that give us continuous unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. Like the workplace, often people aren't as vulnerable because they feel like it's very risky. And so because of that, as adults, we have to build new skills around taking initiative and not just expect friends to kind of come into our lives.
Do you see it that way, Jonathan?
Yeah, you know, when we think about romantic relationships, we're always very aware of the work that we need to put in them to keep them maintained and running well. It's almost like, you know, keeping a car working, you know, changing the tires, putting in gas, you know, all that kind of stuff. But with friends, we tend not to do that. And that's just because there's this weird cultural narrative, like Dr. Franco was saying, that, you know, friends just, they're just there. You can just go to them when you need to, and otherwise you don't need to put in the effort. But in fact, it is just like what Catherine was saying. It's almost like dating. I mean, you're having to put constant effort and energy. I noticed in my own life there have been periods because of moving and all that sort of thing when I've found myself with relatively low friends in the region versus high friends in the region, and I find myself making differential efforts and actually taking that first step and going out and meeting people. I remember when I first moved to San Diego, I met someone. I was like, hey, we should hang out. And I remember when we grabbed coffee the next day, he said something like, I'm really glad you took that step. Like, that was really brave of you. And I kind of laughed to myself years later because it was brave, right? But that's the kind of bravery that we need. Otherwise, we don't change in our relationship with other people. We don't make new friends that actually will end up supporting us.
Well, let me go back to you, Catherine. And one of the things that you write in your article, talking to another friend or expert, a guy named Jeffrey Hall, that it takes something like 200 hours to create a close friend, to turn a stranger into a close friend. But it sounds like from your experience with Steph, is that didn't take 200 hours. I mean, it seems like there was something that was, if not chemistry, something that clicked for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think with Steph, I think it was a handful of things, because I think we definitely had great chemistry, and it was sort of, as soon as we met each other, we met at a wine bar, and we ended up talking for 3 hours, and it was just kind of such a relief where I thought, oh, yeah, this is what I've been kind of looking for and what I've been missing. But I think the other piece with Steph is that she is somebody, she also recently moved to Bozeman. And so she's just really available in a way that a lot of the other women I've been meeting, and I say women intentionally because I think it's interesting that Dr. Bowman was talking about the male aspect of this, because I actually I've heard from so many readers since writing that essay. And I would say by far the largest group I hear from are divorced men who are in their 50s mm-hmm. and 60s who feel really lonely. But I mean, the only thing I would say though is Steph and I are very good friends, but I wouldn't say that we're best friends or very close friends yet, simply because it just hasn't been that long. And I do think time and just constant interaction really does help. So obviously I'd like to see her again and again, but I think it's hard, to replace those or kind of get to those, that level of comfort that we have with people that we were at college with or that really
know us and have some history with us. Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. We're talking about friendships as an adult, how to be an adult friend, how to find an adult friend. Catherine Smythe is a writer. She wrote the recent Atlantic article titled Why Making Friends in Midlife is So Hard, about what happened when she moved to Bozeman, Montana. Jonathan Bowman is a professor of communication studies at the University of San Diego. Marissa Franco is a professor at the University of Maryland and a friendship expert. Let me read a couple of comments that we have here. Beth emailed us right away. She said, by coincidence, my circle of adult friends comprise women like myself who were widowed too young. Not only do we share that bond of loss and resilience, but we can also rely on each other for a ride for our colonoscopies. Let me read another one here. Here's an email from Patty. I'm grateful to live in this era of Zoom to keep in touch with my friends. And let me just pick up on that, because I, you know, Zoom has pros and cons, but I do think, maybe I'll toss this to you, Jonathan Bowman, you know, I do think that it has provided a substitute for so many of us who've been cut off from actually seeing the people that we care about in our lives.
Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating because when we talk about Zoom, what you're doing most of the time on Zoom is talking with one another. And so for relationships that are kind of founded on or focused on that emotional depth, that deep disclosure, the relationship can almost move forward in a similar way to how it has always been. Or if you are in a long-distance friendship with someone, so you're constantly on the phone, Zoom gives you that visual element that actually maybe enhances the overall experience. But for people whose relationships are built on doing things together, it does change the way that that friendship looks. And some of those relationships can be successfully transitioned onto a Zoom situation, but sometimes that's just not in the mindset of either parties, right? So if I don't play basketball, but if you met up regularly with a friend to play basketball, and you know you had this group of people that you spent a lot of time with regularly, Zoom's not going to be able to transition that relationship. Sure. And you might actually not be in touch with those people anymore until situations change. But it is, you know, like you said, it is a great way to keep in contact with those relationships, and you may need to just transition relationships and be intentional about doing so from, you know, these, we see each other at church or we meet up and in our quilting circle or those kinds of things. You may need to transition them to a little bit more about like talking about what's going on or just sharing details about your general life, asking questions, that kind of thing.
Yeah, asking questions. Pamela asks, and let me toss this first to you, Marissa, but I'd like to hear from everybody. She says, can I help my husband find friends? He's an introvert. He and I are friends, if that counts. And he's friends with our kids, but that's all. And I don't think that is enough. Do all of us need a friend? Even, you know, do we all need friends? And can a spouse or a long-term partner be a substitute for a friend?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we find from the research is that we tend to underestimate the value of connection. Before connecting with people, we assume it'll be less enjoyable than it'll actually be. And so I think we can fall into this trap of if we don't have friends, thinking, well, they're not really going to add into my life. And we only get out of that when we actually connect with people and we're like, wow, this actually feels really, really good. That being said, it's definitely hard to like force someone to make friends. I think they do need to be able to take the initiative on themselves. But I think if this person were going to be strategic about encouraging their husband, what I would suggest is encourage the husband to sign up to something that's continuous, like a class, for example, that they're interested in. Because when you have something that's continuous, you capitalize on something called the mere exposure effect, which is a phenomenon that when people become familiar to us, we like them more. This happens completely unconsciously. So we want to look for repeated interaction rather than just asking, you know, going to one-off lecture, one-off happy hour, rather going to a class where we can continue to build that relationship over time. So if she can get him to do that, then he might have more of an opportunity to cultivate friendship.
What do you think, Jonathan? I know you've studied a lot about men and friendship. What can her husband do, or what can she do to help her husband?
Yeah, you know, Dr. Franco's advice is exactly right on, right? So the more opportunity that we have to engage with someone, the more we find similarities and things that we share in common, which is kind of the basic building block of friendship. So, you know, really the key is repeated exposure to the same individual or to a group of individuals until you finally figure out, you know, through that normal filtering process that we all went through on our first day of kindergarten, like figuring out who's your person. And so I think, you know, in the case of the person who wrote in, like, part of it's going to be making sure that her partner gets out there and interacts with other people and does so regularly. It's not just a one-time thing. I think also, you know, spending time with mutual others who might also be able to be friends to one's partner is helpful. It's kind of awkward because it's almost like you're trying to set up your husband on a friend date, you know.
Right.
But to some degree, like that repeated exposure, eventually that might develop into something that person thought was unexpected, but what you were maybe hoping for the whole time.
Catherine, let me go back to you. You moved to Bozeman, Montana. You had close friends from your 20 years living in Brooklyn. How do you maintain your Brooklyn friendships?
I talk on the phone a lot. you know, I walk every day, and I sort of have a list of favorites on my phone, and I sort of just cycle through them. And I've been certainly going back to New York every few months, which I don't think is honestly sustainable. but I like the phone compared to Zoom for whatever reason.
Just hearing someone's voice. I'm kind of a phone person.
And
myself.
Actually, my best friend actually lives in LA, and we have never lived in the same place since high school. And we talk every day. So, and that feels very sustaining to me.
Before we say goodbye to you, let me just quote something that you quote in your article. And this was Emily Dickinson talking about friendship. It's just such a lovely sentence. She says, "My only sketch profile of heaven is a large blue sky, bluer and larger than the biggest I have seen in June. And in it are my friends, all of them, every one of them." Any final words, Catherine, before we say goodbye to you?
I mean, no, except that I agree that Dickinson quote is so beautiful and really, really just spoke to me about what friendship means and the sense of fulfillment that I honestly think friendship alone can provide.
Is that what you hear, Marissa?
Absolutely. I read that quote. I was like, oh my gosh, I teach psychology of friendship. I'm going to put this in there. It's just so, so beautiful. And I don't know. I think friendship is so sacred, and even though it's so trivialized, that it can be so monumental in our lives. And I felt like that quote really embodied it, that friendship doesn't have to be an inferior relationship, that it can be so fulfilling, like the heavens, like the skies.
Like the big blue sky. Well, Marissa Franco is going to stay with us. She's a professor at the University of Maryland, a friendship expert. Also with us, Jonathan Bowman. He's a professor of communication studies at the University of San Diego. We say goodbye to Catherine Smythe, a writer. You can read her recent Atlantic article titled "Why Making Friends in Midlife is So Hard." Catherine, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And do stay with us and do join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Talking about friends, adult friends, friends when we're all grown up. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends.
And that's Dionne Warwick. That's what friends are for. That's from 1985. It actually won a Grammy Award that year and featured Stevie Wonder, Elton John, and Gladys Knight. And yes, we are talking about friendship, adult friendship, today on Radio Times. Here's an email from William, and I want to put that to you, Dr. Franco. He says, "Can you comment on having close friends of the opposite sex? I've heard people say it's not possible for heterosexuals. Is that true?"
Oh, that's absolutely false. I would say it's totally possible to have close friends of opposite sex. It's funny because this lies on the assumption that bisexual people can't have any friends at all.
Exactly.
They're attracted
right.
to multiple different genders. You know, when we say that we can't have friends of the opposite sex, we assume that we're sexually attracted to everybody of the opposite sex. And we assume that friendship doesn't happen alongside sexual attraction, which it does, right? Some people are friends with people they're attracted to, even if they're not engaged in a sexual relationship, which that marks a non-friendship when you start having sex with someone. So yeah, I think there's a lot of assumptions underlying that aren't true, but I will say that it points to a ways that we are socialized, right? That sometimes we are socialized to only look at a different gender in terms of what they can provide us sexually or romantically. And I think that really harms us, right? Because like I said, Men in particular sometimes experience the most intimacy in their relationships with women. And so being open to friendships of different genders can actually mean that you experience like greater intimacy, greater support, different types of perspectives. And so I just encourage people to really value people of all genders for what they can bring to their lives outside of something romantic and or sexual.
And to you, Dr. Berman, I want to pile on that, genders and generations too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really interesting to think about just how important it is to get perspectives that are different from your own. I mean, that's what helps you grow as a person. That's part of the goal of friendship, is to help you navigate increasingly complicated situations. And so different genders, different generations, different experiences. These are, you know, there's a reason that there's so much push for increasing diversity, because you get access to other people and other ideas. We need that in our own personal lives as well. So making a friend who is significantly older than you may not be something that you thought was in the cards, but it may actually be incredibly beneficial for you down the long run.
Here's a question from Ruth Ann. Are friendships in the workplace a good thing? Should we have them, or is there a possibility it will interfere with our career? And Dr. Franco, I'll go back to you. I mean, in many ways, I probably spend more time with my, you know, my work colleagues than I do with almost anyone else in my life, my spouse included. Should we think about the workplace as a place where we have friends?
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for asking this question. This is something that I actually speak on, belonging at work and how important it is, because I think we tend to engage in something that I like to call the employee myth, which is the idea that when we come to work, we no longer have fundamental human needs. We're just become employees and we can just clack away at our computers. But in fact, making friends at work is related to being more productive, being more likely to stay in your position, being more fulfilled in work, being more satisfied in the workplace, being more innovative, cooperating better on teams, like all of the different outcomes that people are looking for in a workplace. Friendship really, really helps provide. And I think the problem is that we often in the workplace feel like we need to be such a stilted version of ourselves. And Hall's study that Catherine referenced actually found that the more time we spend with people at work, the less close we tend to feel to them, which
really?
Is really weird.
That is weird.
Yeah, isn't that weird? But my sort of hypothesis is that it's because we're often not vulnerable with our work friends. We only show them one side of ourselves. And to develop a connection with someone, you need to stop talking about work. You need to start sharing who you are as a person, your hobbies, your interests, you know. And so I think workplaces that really understand the science would really encourage people to feel more comfortable bringing their true self to work and fostering connection that is so necessary for us to thrive in the workplace.
Dr. Berman, let me toss something else on the table for discussion about breaking up with adult friends. I mean, I think it sometimes happens that you grow apart, or, you know, you become different people as you become adults. And maybe that friendship doesn't mean the same thing to one or both of the people. I think the tendency is to kind of just disappear and kind of ghost somebody. How do you responsibly break up with an adult friend?
Yeah, well, you know, so there's two different issues there. I think the first one is, you know, as a relationship changes, right, if you're putting in the effort, that relationship can still be maintained at that same level of intimacy. The key is just a lot of times with friends when we're drifting apart, part of the thing is we're not putting the effort in. So to some degree, maybe the drifting apart is just an example of us not working quite as hard as our relationship. You know, our relationships don't have to be with people who are exactly the same as us. In fact, it does give us a lot of extra support and energy to have someone with a completely different perspective, because they can offer new insight to what we're going through. But if you and or the other person have determined that the relationship kind of shouldn't continue any longer, you're right. We tend to ghost people, but sometimes it's better to have a kind of clear conversation, just explaining like, hey, you know, things seem to have changed. I might not be able to hang out with you as much as I have previously, or, you know, that just kind of being a little bit more open and honest can cause it to end a little bit more amicably. And then maybe if the relationship changes in the future, you can still have more of an opportunity to engage in the future. So it's really interesting, because, you know, ghosting is the easiest way to deal with it. But then you have, you know, one person on the other end that's constantly trying to reach out to pick that relationship back up when you have no intention of doing so. And that can actually be much more painful for both parties, because there's that constant reminder of the disconnect in the relationship.
And here's a related question, Dr. Franco, dealing with conflicts in friendship. I mean, these things happen. People have disagreements. They have They have misunderstandings of things that can lead to conflict. Do we deal with conflict among our friends the way we would deal with conflict among our partners or spouses?
We tend to bring it up way less. We tend to use conflict, yeah, with our friends than our romantic partners. And we tend to use a rupture as a sign that maybe the relationship should end, which is so interesting, right? Because if we did that in our marriages, the divorce rate would be 100%. And so we tend to really avoid conflict with friends because we think we might make things worse, when in fact the research finds that open and empathic conflict actually creates more intimacy. And you can unlock a deeper level of honesty and trust with your friends if you are able to work through conflict. That being said, it depends on how you have the conflict. Attacking and blaming a friend for something is not going to make the relationship better, but you know, sharing that you want to have conflict as a sign that you are invested in this friendship, like, I really care about this, I want to make sure we work through any issues that come up between us, using I statements, like, I felt hurt when this happened, asking about their world, perspective taking, what's going on for you, what are you thinking about, expressing needs, like, this is what I'd love to see in the future, like, that sort of very healthy communication style is what can create more intimacy within our friends than if we never had the issue or if we have never had the disagreement, because it gives us a chance to prove that, hey, I'm in this, I'm going to be responsive to your needs. And that responsiveness is key to healthy functioning of any relationship.
Because the other person matters, right? They matter to you.
Yeah, exactly. It shows, and when someone brings up conflict with us, it shows us that we matter to them, right? They didn't just ghost on us. They didn't just back away. And so I think, you know, writing this book has really changed the way I view conflict. Like, it's an opportunity to be illuminated as to how you could treat people in your life better. And that is such a gift.
Indeed. Here's a tweet from Kara saying, moving to the city and having close neighbors, walking and biking places drastically improved my social network and my sense of community. An email from Helen, she says, if you want to have a friend, you have to be a friend. The me perspective does not nurture friendships. She goes on to say, I have a neighbor who thinks he has friends because he reads about people on Facebook. To me, there is no different that is no different than reading about B-list celebrities in the checkout line. Friendship takes effort. You've got to get off the couch and off your phone. I will leave that there. Here's an email from Ryan. Maybe I'm lucky. My wife is my best friend. We both have hobbies and friends outside as well. But at the end of the day, we don't want to hang out with anyone else. We just really like being with each other. I mean, Dr. Bowman, nothing wrong with that, right?
Well, you know, I think one of the keys there is that he pointed out that he does have outside friends and outside hobbies, outside people that he's engaging with still. I think it'd be unhealthy to only spend all your time with one other person. But if you still have those other systems of support out there that can, you know, keep that you can go to when you're having a problem with that one person who's your one and only, that's going to be pretty healthy. That's a really good idea. I mean, you know, we want to spend time with the people that we want to spend time with, and friends should be added into that mix. But absolutely, if your partner is your best friend, like, you should be spending the majority of your friendship time with them.
Here's an email from Loretta. I'm 71 years old. My husband and I sold our home, moved to an apartment building 6 years ago, and I knew no one. After a couple of years, I met one woman. She and I started a women's group in our building. I cannot believe how successful it has become and how the group has grown. We now have a book club. We meet for lunch once a month and plan special events. And she goes on from there. To you, Marissa Franco, I mean, it's good to have activities, I guess, in common, right?
Absolutely. Like, just having something that anchors you. I mean, it seems like what she did was she created continuous unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. And I think activities that anchor us can really do that. Like, for me and my friends, I started a wellness group where we met up each week and we meditated and we cooked and we read books together. And that was in our calendars already. That was something we showed up to. That was a common interest that we had. And so it gave us an excuse and a reason to meet up. And I think when it comes to friendship, one of the biggest barriers that I see is people are so afraid of rejection, so they fail to reach out. And so when you already have that pre-scheduled plan to meet up, nobody has to face their fears of rejection. They know it's already in the calendar, and that's why it's a really effective way to build connections with people.
But I certainly have met people in a spontaneous way walking around my neighborhood, or even at a party, I'll meet another person or another couple that I really like, and we have become friends. I mean, there are those spontaneous moments when friendship can happen. I don't think everything has to be planned, does it, Dr. Franco?
No, know. Not everything. I mean, I think friendship can happen in all different types of ways. This is just a way to make it easier. But I think, you know, obviously you can also, you know, have some spontaneous conversation, spontaneous dialogue. I think it's great that you're initiating conversation, right? Because people often just walk by their neighbors and they don't necessarily say anything. And so that's also a really important bit of initiative, which is just saying like, hi, hello, this is my name. This, you know, my name is XYZ. I'm so happy to have met you. You know, I live here, you know, inviting someone over for tea eventually. But, you know, when you live next to people, it's also a little bit easier to foster connection, right? Because you almost have continuous unplanned interaction embedded a little bit. Like you can kind of bump into each other and you have proximity. So when there's proximity to someone, there's a lower barrier to entry for seeing them. And that tends to promote friendship, particularly when it's new friendship, when there's a lower barrier to entry. So I think it's also really strategic to make friends with people that are your neighbors.
Well, here's an interesting email from Ronald. He says, can you address friendships across political affiliations in today's environment? And this is a tough one, Jonathan.
Yeah, you know, I think the key is to decide if the political affiliations are core to yourself and to your relationship, right? I mean, it's easy not to worry about different political ideologies if you're meeting up to play board games once a week at a local pub or something like that. Like, in that case, it's probably not going to come up. But if kind of emotional intimacy or intellectual intimacy is an important part of that relationship, then you're going to have to talk through some of those things. I mean, fortunately, if you approach it in an empathic way, you know, you're really trying to take the perspective of the other person and understand where they come from. You can oftentimes still find commonalities with someone whose behaviors are completely different, completely separate, completely opposite from your own. The key is just really, again, putting in that effort to decide like, hey, this person is very different from me, but I still want to have them as a friend. How can we approach our interactions with each other in a positive, affirming way that might expand both of our opinions, even if it doesn't change our minds?
Yeah. How do you see that, Dr. Franco?
This is a tough question. I was like, I'm glad she asked him.
I gave you a minute to think about your answer. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is what I'll say, right? In any friendship, there are pros and cons, right? And we evaluate, do the pros outweigh the cons? And for all of our friendships, the answer should be yes. For me, the pros outweigh the cons. So I'm continuing this friendship. And so I think, like Dr. Bowman says, it takes a personal valuing process. Hey, is this con of political difference for me? And how much do I weigh that con, right? To decide if you want to continue the relationship. And that being said, the calculus will be different depending on if this is a new friend or a friend that you've had since you were a child, right? Because now, even if they may have this political difference that matters to you, that is a con, you have a lot more pros to weigh in the relationship. You have history together. You have shared memories. You might have a deeper level of intimacy. And so I think it just takes taking a step back, looking at the relationship more holistically and getting really clear on how much you value political, how much you value politics, like Dr. Bowman said, as part of your identity, or how much you value that in a friendship, to really decide and discern how ready are you to engage with friends across political differences.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Good answer there, Dr. Franco. And I appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times. Dr. Marissa Franco, professor at the University of Maryland, a friendship expert. She's got a forthcoming book titled Platonic. And thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And Dr. Jonathan Bowman, professor of communication studies at the University of San Diego, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
You're very welcome. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we do want to close things out with one more song. This is Old Friends by Simon and Garfunkel, released in their 1968 album, Bookends.
Old friends, sat on their park bench like bookends, a newspaper blown through the grass falls on the round toes of the high shoes of the old friends. Old friends, winter companions, the old men lost in their overcoats, waiting for the sunset.
The sounds of the city sifting through trees settle like dust on the shoulders of the old.